Welcome to the Invest Like a Boss podcast.
I'm Sam Marks.
And I'm Johnny FD. We're self-made entrepreneurs who invest our own money and use modern technology to invest like a boss.
Join us each week for exclusive interviews with our network of modern investors, business owners, and multimillionaires to discover new ways to invest our hard-earned cash.
Hey guys, it's Johnny and welcome to episode 118 of the Invest Like a Boss podcast. That was Sam Marks bringing it in with a nice jingle. Welcome, Sam.
Hey buddy, how you doing?
Yeah, good to talk to you. So you are in Tampa?
Tampa, baby. I just got back from Tampa, Tahoe. Went out there for a good 8 days of skiing. Bro, it was the best snow season I've ever seen anywhere. It was insane.
Wow, nice.
Oh, it's good times. Yeah.
I had no idea that you went to Nevada or to Tahoe.
You know, I got to sneak away from Florida while I have the opportunity. I might turn around twice and be 65 and retired here and just never have left.
But yeah, I mean, how long were you even back in Tampa? Because the last time I spoke to you, yeah. The last time I spoke to you, you were in Japan, and then, oh man, I can't keep up with you.
Honestly, I say I wasn't happy to leave Tampa. It's nice here right now. It's super nice, and it's developing so quick. There's great restaurants, eateries, coffee shops, co-working spaces. It's turning into a really good city. I didn't want to leave, but when I got to Tahoe, I'm like, this is my favorite place in the USA. Skiing in Tahoe in the winter. Well, of course, the only time you can ski, there's nothing better. There's no better experience in the USA. Up there, drinking an IPA, ripping down some slopes. Man, I love it.
Nice. Well, I think that's a good base. I actually had looked into moving to the Nevada side of Tahoe. That way you can still avoid state income tax, but still be in Tahoe.
I highly recommend it. It's a great area. Reno is actually developing quite quickly as well, and you're 35 minutes to South Lake Tahoe.
Yeah, I actually looked into Reno as well as a possible place to live back in the U.S.
Well, once you get your affairs in line, Johnny, and all your estate planning up to date, you can start making moves like this with a lot more confidence.
Yeah, I guess so. So I actually am excited for this episode because I don't even have a will. And these are things that and I think all my money, well, not all of it, like half my money is going to my ex-girlfriend still, which we broke up 3 years ago.
Oh, you're so kind. See what happens when you date Johnny? You get in his will as long as you tell him to update it.
Yeah. But at the same time, you know, like I'm sure I'll change that the next time I have a dependent. But I mean, right now, I guess I never have to think about it because I don't have that much money. And also, I don't have any dependents. I don't have any kids. I'm not married. So if I die, you know, I don't really care that much because of my money because, you know, it's like nobody really needs it.
Yeah. Well, you guys will find out on this episode, estate planning is a very broad topic. It's more than just death planning. But we'll talk more about this on the intro, or I'm sorry, outro. But speaking to Matt, like off the record, I mean, a lot of people just don't think about this at any wealth level, whether you have $1 million, $20 million, $100 million, people typically don't like dealing with it. It's not fun. But nevertheless, it's very important.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And if nothing else, I wouldn't want other people to have to deal with my crap if I died. I wouldn't want to be a hassle to people. You know, I wouldn't want to cause rifts and have people fight, you know, especially family members argue or fight over things. Yeah. I wouldn't want them having to get hassled. And I remember, actually my ex-girlfriend, when her mom passed away, there was a ton of like fighting back and forth between like her mom's boyfriend that she was living with and then like the other family members. And it just ended up being a lot of like headache and a lot of heartbreak. I mean, the last thing you want to deal with if someone's passed, you know, when someone passes away is legal stuff and, you know, arguing back and forth who deserves what. So I think if nothing else, by us having all these things planned out, it just makes other people's lives easier.
Yeah. So this episode is going to touch on all that. I agree with Johnny on how you need to think about these things. It's your money, it's your investments, it's your family, it's your relationships, it's your legacy. So a lot of things to think about. We have on Matt Wiley onto this episode who specializes in estate planning, also a good, great business advisor and has been to me for quite a while. So I hope you guys hear stay on and listen to what Matt has to say, and Johnny and I will have takeaways talking about estate planning in the outro.
Yeah, I'm definitely excited to hear what Sam Marx is doing with his estate planning. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to be asking you at the end of this episode. But for now, let's hear what Matt had to say.
Welcome back onto the show. Today, we're going to talk about estate planning. And we have my buddy and trusted confidant, Matt Wiley, on. Matt, welcome to the show.
Good to be here. How are you doing, Sam?
I'm doing great. I'm doing great. You know, asset protection, estate planning, especially estate planning, I think it's got a pretty good little jingle to it. It sounds like you have this massive estate, maybe Rockefeller's house, or what's that place in North Carolina? Biltmore's. You know, you're planning your estate. But I think that's kind of on the surface. Then when you peel back the layers, it's a little bit more like maybe something like death planning. But, you know, how do you kind of summarize it and picture it in your own profession?
Well, it's kind of interesting because the average person doesn't even know what estate planning is. And from like a marketing standpoint and keywords and stuff like that, our business is really driven by the word will and the word trust. It's getting a little better, but no one really even knows what an estate plan is. And will and trust are both words that are associated with death. Mm-hmm. When you die, where do your assets go? And the problem is estate planning is so much more than that. It's also about lifetime planning. So asset accumulation, sort of how do we accumulate our wealth so that we can transfer it to the next generation and achieve our goals. But in order to have that conversation, we have to kind of have a really detailed review of your financial assets, your personal assets, who you love, who you care about. And that leads itself almost more to like a financial advisory practice before you even get to the legal document side of things. So when I look at myself as an estate planner, I like to think of myself as the most trusted confidant, helping you reach your business, financial, and personal goals without alienating any of your family members. To me, that is estate planning. Making sure you reach those those points in the future.
Mm. At what point in someone's life, like what is the time in someone's life, whether it's tied more to age or more to capital, that someone starts taking estate planning more seriously or comes to you?
Seriously is an interesting question. People take it seriously when they've accumulated assets and they're getting closer to quote unquote dying, as you mentioned before, because everyone just kind of thinks of it as just a will. I mean, I could make a pretty easy argument that everyone from year 18 onward needs to do some level of estate planning. What I think people don't understand is there's degrees and tiers. You can do an online estate plan real quick at 18 to cover all your needs, or you can spend $500,000 with a complicated succession plan. I mean, there's everything in between depending, and I think everyone really needs it. I mean, we're doing this college plan right now just for parents right now with the kids in college, giving them documents so they can view their kids' grades in school, because technically once you're 18 you're an individual. So even things like that, I mean, such a, you would think trivial, but it really matters to people a lot. I'd say that falls under estate planning as well.
Mm-hmm. What is kind of the backbone of estate planning? What's the first thing that you start analyzing or putting into play when someone comes to you and says, hey, I need to get this stuff taken care of?
Well, what's interesting about my practice is, because, and I know you know this, Sam, but I kind of came up in the financial industry. So I worked in wealth planning for years before I even became an attorney. So when someone comes to me, I want to make sure immediately that I know everything about them and I'm the smartest guy in the room. So I sit them down and I go through a very detailed family sort of fact-finding analysis, and we go through each family member. What are their goals? What are their dreams? What are their hopes for each person? And from there, we transition second, not first, into the balance sheet and kind of what assets they have, taking all those items into sort of figuring out what your goals are. Like, what are your life goals? Do you want to make X millions of dollars in the next 5 years, or you just want to retire soon? I mean, that all kind of goes in that realm of estate planning, even though your estate planner is probably not managing your money. He might be your trusted confidant to kind of give you advice on some of your other professionals, because he knows a lot about a lot of different things. So once you've laid that foundation and you've really gotten to know your attorney or your estate planner and start building that trust, there are a couple basic documents that everybody needs in estate planning. Pretty easy to understand, and they're actually kind of fun to talk about, sadly. You know, I'm a nerd when I'm laughing about documents, mm-hmm. but maybe it's a good idea to just kind of outline them real quick.
Yeah.
But The first one's called a durable power of attorney, or your financial power of attorney. And I know we've all kind of watched the movie, and you see someone coming at the last minute and go, stop everything, I have power of attorney, and they all listen to him. So this document actually lets someone step in your shoes and sign contracts on your behalf, Sam. So if you were to make me, for example, your power of attorney, I could actually sell one of your businesses, and my signature would be good enough to do it, to do that, which is really important because you don't know where you're going to be. So some of these people could be using it for, and God forbid they get into a coma or get sick, but a lot of other people do it just, hey, I'm going out of town, I'm going out of the country, I want to make these various transactions. The power of attorney or financial power of attorney can step right in and do that for you. So people don't realize that's probably the single most important document in an estate plan. And it's not expensive. I mean, it's something you can get. You can sometimes you can get them online, or you can even go to a lawyer. Like I don't charge much, maybe $100 to do this document. It's very inexpensive, but crucial, because when things go wrong, it lets you kind of save the boat. You know what I mean? You go missing or anything along those lines. So that's the most important and first document. The second document is called a healthcare power of attorney. Same idea as the financial power of attorney, but it's for medical decisions. You're in the hospital, you're not able to speak, they have to decide if they should operate on you. This person gets to make that decision. Yeah, cut off his arm, don't cut off his arm. This is what a lot of people come to my office concerned about, strangely enough. Everyone goes, hey, what's going to happen if I'm in the hospital? I actually distinguish this from the next document, which is called a living will. A living will is sort of, I mean, you ever heard of Terry Schiavo, Sam?
No, I have not.
Well, there's a case about, it was almost 20 years ago now, so it's been quite some time, down in Florida. And the story was essentially this woman was in a coma and her husband wanted to pull the plug and her parents did not. And they fought for like 10 years over whether or not to pull the plug while she was essentially on a respirator and feeding tubes and all of this stuff. A living will is actually you writing a letter to your doctor saying, if I ever become a vegetable, I have no chance of coming back. It's not like they can do a surgery and save you. It's your instruction telling them to let you go, which sounds kind of like common sense, but I always advise my clients kind of interestingly. Imagine you're sitting down with your spouse and she has this type of situation. If your spouse had already prepared a living will, that means that her parents are going to be very mad at the doctor. Mm-hmm. They're not going to be mad at you. So it sounds kind of that you can understand how important that would be, because God forbid if you are passing away, you don't want your family fighting over it. You want to kind of make that clarity, and like doctors can handle it. But if you're the husband and you're making that decision for your wife, that could, you might have to live with that the rest of your life. You have to live with the parents, everyone thinking that they knew more than you or you made the wrong decision. One of the last documents is called a HIPAA. Which everyone's probably heard of, and that's pretty much just allows people to view your medical files. I'm a big believer that you're just because you want someone to make medical decisions for you doesn't mean they're the only people you want to be able to ask questions. So like my healthcare power of attorney, I'd probably have a spouse or maybe like a parent on there, but maybe I want my sisters to be able to ask questions but not actually make decisions. HIPAA's great for adding more people too. Now some attorneys take the healthcare power of attorney, the HIPAA, and the living will, and they put it all in one document. I split them between three documents because they're all kind of separate and they're all very interesting in what they work and important. So those basic documents are called essentially the ancillary documents of estate planning. That's what you need during life to just be protected in case something goes wrong from 18 onward. Very, very inexpensive. Some of the online services do a pretty good job with them as well. Definitely important to have done.
Yeah, that's great. And I don't have any of those done. So that's recommendations for just about anybody, irregardless of your wealth level.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, a lot of people also come in and they ask about sort of a designation of guardianship, which is arguably the last ancillary document. And that's just saying simply who gets your kids if you get disabled or if you pass away, which is, I think, what most people, what triggers them to start thinking about estate planning. Hey, I have kids. What happens to them?
Do you have to get approval from the parties that you indicate you want to have custody?
You don't. What's really interesting is when people sign a designation of guardianship, they always assume that it's like binding and your kids go to this place. Mm-hmm. But American law, and I'm licensed in Connecticut, New York, and Florida, so there's some variation on this, but the general rule is your parents don't have that much of a strong say. The judge actually chooses. What the designation of guardianship, how I like to word it, is more like a letter with a strong suggestion to the judge. Mm-hmm. And then the judge sort of does, hey, what's best for the child? And then he ultimately makes a decision. And the older the kids are, the more say they have. It kind of goes back to what I said earlier in the meeting where your estate planning attorney should want to be the smartest guy in the room. Mm-hmm. God forbid you did pass away, Sam. I'd want to be the one talking to the judge, telling all the reasons why you chose a specific guardian. And if I go back on my notes, I should have that in my file. It's really compelling. And now, we haven't talked too much, but it's all about the relationship.
Now, in that case, and going back also to the power of attorney, do you recommend that most people put for the, I think the durable power of attorney was the first one that you mentioned?
Yes.
Is that something that you typically put a lawyer on, or you know, a family member or a trusted friend, or all of them?
It could be any of them. I mean, most people would choose a family member. If you don't have a good family member, you'll often choose your lawyer. The lawyer is always a safe option for that role, mm-hmm. though they do charge for it. Just if, God forbid, you needed to pay a lawyer to make sure your affairs are together while you're in a coma. Mm-hmm. Years ago, I worked with a doctor that had that sort of situation as well. And his power of attorney was able to kind of hire us. And we were then hiring temporary doctors to run his practice for 6 months. And he woke up and he still had a business when he got awake. So mm-hmm. even if you have to pay a lawyer to do that role, it's not the end of the world. But most people choose a family member, sometimes multiple. So just so you have a little check and a balance. And sometimes it's an attorney, like you have an attorney on one side and you have a family member on the other, just kind of even each other out a little bit.
And in that case where you would have two people, you would say, okay, they both have to agree or nothing happens, or you have like a preference order, like, okay, this person's first, and if they're not available, then use this person as power of attorney.
Well, usually in the financial power of attorney, we do two signatures required, mostly because nothing's urgent with money. I mean, people can wait a couple days, mm-hmm. So we let them track them down. With the health care, I mean, your health is life and death. I mean, that's really important. We'll usually have either joint, whoever's present makes the decision, mm-hmm. and ultimately, if that person's missing, they'll go to the next one on the list. I mean, all this is subject to how you want it. They're all custom documents, but my preference is we wait around for money. Who cares if your bills are a little bit late? That's not that big a deal. But if the doctor's waiting to find out if you need a heart transplant, I mean, mm-hmm. time is important. Right. So
interesting. So that's all kind of the decision-making stuff. You know, how does this transition, where does estate planning go into financial well-keep being, and then also, of course, handing that over as inheritance to your heirs?
Well, the financial well-being part is kind of interesting, because now that we know you really well, we've set everything up. I mean, you're going to be reaching out and talking every few years, and you're going to be getting their advice and kind of figure out where they go. The first time that really happens when you start planning out whether you need a will or a trust, and we could talk a bit about the difference, but once you decide where your assets are going to go, you're going to start wondering, do you have enough of them? How do you get more? What is that? What's made up of those assets? I mean, you could be worth $50 million, and if $49 million of that is your business and you can't see it split up and sold, how are you going to give it to multiple kids? Mm-hmm. So you start kind of getting into the nitty gritty of sort of where do you see your legacy going? Mm-hmm. And there's two main ways to do that on the simple phrase, or you could even say three. One would be without a will, which is what most people have. And every state has a plan that they've written for you. It doesn't usually say what you want it to say. It's usually some combination of your spouse and your kids. And then if they're both deceased and it goes to your parents and along those lines, the biggest thing I want to leave you with is you just don't know. It should scare you that can be changed by the legislator at any time. And it gets changed from time to time. That's called dying intestate. The second way would be dying with a will, which a will is actually really, it's kind of boring in that you just say, if I die, Sam gets all my money, mm-hmm. or you split it three different ways. Couple things about that cause a problem for business owners and investors. The first is that means that pretty much the age 18, your kids get a check in the mail for everything you have. That scares most people because kids are stupid at 18, right. Honestly. Right. So you can put some tiers on it and be like, hey, I want my kid to wait till he's 25 to get half. But then you're usually subject to probate court oversight every year until they reach 18. This is an interesting thing to talk about very quickly. Probate court oversight means paying the judge and paying lawyers every year, which gets rather expensive. And unfortunately, it means everything's public. I don't know if you know this, but like Elvis Presley's will's available. I mean, his estate's still open. Whitney Houston's, she passed away with I think just a simple will. So that's in probate. So everyone can see their affairs. I don't know, Sam, have you ever tried to, I know you've sold a couple businesses in your career, have you ever tried to sell a business when the other person knows all the details of, like can see all the details, all your financials, everything behind the scenes, everything you're possibly hiding. I mean, it makes it hard when you need to sell quickly and there's no secrets at all.
Right.
So that's one of the big issues in that it's a public process,
okay.
Which kind of gets us to the next area. If you do have assets and you want to control them more, living trust, which is sort of, I like to call it a fancy will, but it's often used to avoid probate a little bit, definitely avoids probate for multiple years, maybe not the first. Like Connecticut's one state where even if you do a trust, you still have to go to probate for a year, but 1 year is not the end of the world. But what's cool about the living trust is the actual words in your document are private. They're not publicly available. So if you leave all your money to me, Sam, nobody knows you left me all your money. In a will, it's there clear as day. Mm-hmm. So that's really kind of important. The other thing about a trust is I like to describe it as sort of a blank sheet of paper. So anything you can dream up, I can make happen. So if you want your businesses to keep running after you pass away, because, I mean, you have employees, a lot of them are like family in some ways. A lot of small business owners think that their legacy is in some ways more important than just cash, giving cash to their kids. They want their business to grow, you know, keep evolving. And what we do is we appoint sort of a board of directors or sort of like quasi CEO to keep running the business after death. And yeah, maybe it'll dissolve one day and your heirs will get money from it. But we can kind of put that all in that living trust document. The first area we kind of get into asset protection and why living trust is a great asset protection tool, A, you can put guidelines on how you want your businesses run in the event you get disabled in that trust. So for example, you could say, I want these businesses sold mm-hmm. in the event that I get disabled immediately, or I want them to keep running, or I want these different things. And the second is should you pass away, the living trust will create this trust vehicle for your friends, family, kids, whoever. And that is actually an asset protection trust, if set up correctly. What we usually do is the IRS says you're allowed to have access to your trust for health, education, and maintenance if you're your own trustee. And as long as you limit yourself to those three things or have an outside independent trustee like your lawyer that you've hopefully become good friends with over the years, it's kind of better than a prenup in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. It's not considered a marital asset. You can actually potentially file for bankruptcy while having money in this trust because the very definition of trust is unique in that you don't actually own the assets. Sam, if you had a trust created by, say, your father for you and he passed away and I'm your trustee, making me trustee actually, if the trust is developed correctly, which should be sort of a discretionary trust, meaning I have discretion to give you money or the ability to say no, you come, you say, hey, give me $50. I say no. There's not a lot you can do about it. Mm-hmm. So if you get sued by a bad business deal and they say, hey, give me $100, I say no, you can't force me to give it to you, nor can they. So that's sort of how you've managed to shelter your assets. Now you say, hey, Matt, I don't have any money. I really want a condo in the Caribbean. Okay, I'm your trustee. I have the ability to buy you a condo in the Caribbean, so I buy you a condo. But because I'm really sneaky, I'm probably going to buy it in the trust. Mm-hmm. Because once I give you money in your name, your creditors can get it, Sam. Mm. They can actually attach it. But as long as it's owned by the trust, there's only one way to get at it, and that's a court order. And maybe I'm just kind of a jerk. I don't know. But I always say busting a trust is not meant to be easy. Mm-hmm. I can't say that I will fight forever, but a judge pretty much has to hold the trustee in contempt. Mm-hmm. So when the judge says, give Sam money so he can give it to his creditors, and I say no, the judge has debatable authority over you depending on a lot of laws, like what jurisdiction, etc. But ultimately, because it's my discretion, if I keep saying no, the only way he can change that, because they can't by court order really take the money arguably, mm-hmm. he just throws you in contempt. And I like to joke, I'll stay in jail for, you know, one, maybe two nights for my client. At a certain point in time, I'd like to go see my family. that's trust busting 101. Mm-hmm. But it never gets there because the beauty of a trust is it starts a settlement conversation. Mm-hmm. So if you know it's going to cost $100,000 to pierce the Sam Marks Trust, for example, you might accept a much lower settlement.
Got it.
To make that problem go away. That's sort of the basic tenet of asset protection trust. It's the easiest one to create, but somebody has to create it for you. If that makes sense.
So you can't create it in your name.
Not, well, I mean, that's not this type exactly.
Okay.
There are other types of trusts, which we call irrevocable trusts. This living trust or revocable living trust, it's revocable. You can change it. You have full control during your life. Those same rules apply to irrevocable trusts, but every state has different rules, and some states let you create trusts for yourself. They get a little bit tricky. You have to pick essentially a self-settled asset protection trust state, like Nevada, Alaska, Wyoming, Delaware, Rhode Island, South Dakota. I think that's about it right now. Florida's not one. Connecticut's not one. New York's not one. But that's a whole nother avenue. And the biggest thing to realize when you get into really how to create asset protection trusts, which are pretty much the best way to protect your assets. I know that's not exactly the topic of this conversation, but it's a good leeway into it. The asset protection trust technique, while expensive, means you're taking a bucket of money and you're giving up some rights to it. So right now, if I have $100,000, I can go buy a nice fancy car with it. But once I put it in the trust, I now have to ask somebody else, or I'm subject to some rules. So you're probably asking, you put 100 grand in this trust and I'm your trustee, Sam. You say, hey, I want to buy a Porsche. I can say yes to that, but I can also say no. So you've given up some access. But because of that, again, it goes back to that conversation about how do your creditors touch that money. Now, if you're really technical, if you go to a state like Nevada, which is probably the best right now, they have a very technical LLC statute, which so you put an LLC inside of the trust, and the law has been designed. They're pretty hard to pierce. I always talk about asset protection on sort of a speed bump scale. Like, nothing's bulletproof, but the more speed bumps you put in the road and the larger they are, the slower the cars are going to go. Mm-hmm. I always like to joke that the asset protection trust is the 8 or 9 level speed bump on a 1 to 10 scale. What's really fascinating, and again, estate planning and asset protection, they overlap. Most people, when they think asset protection, create an LLC, and they're like, I feel great. It's a single member LLC. Mm-hmm. On that speed bump test, a single member LLC is like a 1. It's really low down the totem pole, to the point I think they're kind of oversold and over-focused on, because they don't hold up that often, to be honest.
Right.
I just threw a lot at you.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
Well, the trust stuff has always kind of confused me, because I think everyone's situation is different. But maybe let's start with this. From your experience, where is most people's vulnerability when it comes to why they would set up an asset protection trust? Is it marriage and divorce? Is it malpractice? Is it, you know, getting in a fight at a bar and some type of accident, pushing their shopping cart into somebody? Where is the vulnerability that forces people into one of these asset protection structures?
Okay, well, there's two answers to that question. On the parent side, meaning your parents are creating a trust for you, mm-hmm. it's almost always divorce or drugs. Mm-hmm. They're concerned that you're going to get divorced, squander all the money, do dumb things. That's what really drives a lot of my practice, is parents want to have some control, some oversight. They want to kind of instill the values that they have always put on their kids, and they want to carry forward. Because mm-hmm. it's kind of silly, but the last document or the last expression of your personality that your family's ever going to see is going to be your trust document. Mm. So by making it really custom and unique to them, you can both protect them and guide them a little bit, which is neat. Mm-hmm. The second answer to your question is, okay, I'm a successful businessman. Why do I want to go from the revocable trust into, say, self-settled, irrevocable trust planning? That is almost always business exposure. It's not so much the bar fight that they worry about, really. It's, what if my business goes under? Or what if I get sued for $50 million? How will my other assets be sheltered? Mm-hmm. And that's actually really tricky to do, because when you think about creating an asset protection trust, you want to put as much money in there as possible, right? Mm-hmm. That's kind of the goal. The problem is you get into this sort of fox and hen house situation, where if you put your most valuable asset, and it's a business, into a trust, and then you put another business into the trust, you've now let all the business creditors into your trust, right? So you have to be really careful about what you put in an asset protection trust. Usually you're going to want to put cash. Maybe you have the business put a promissory note into it, something along those lines, because you don't want anything with liability. So let's say you have a rental property in the Netherlands and you're worried about someone slipping and falling and suing you. You don't really want that in an asset protection trust. Mm-hmm. There's too much exposure. So you want your cash, your stocks, your bonds, maybe your safe businesses, notes, promises from those businesses. But you want to keep it as clean as possible.
Now, I've always thought that when you set up a trust, you are gaining protection against something, but you're also giving up something. And I think that you kind of coined it before as access. Is that true in almost all scenarios, like in this asset protection trust? If you put all of your stock, bonds, liquid assets into this, you know, where's your access limited?
It's a great question, Sam. There is no free lunch. Mm-hmm. So if it sounds like you're creating a trust that you have your cake and eat it too, you don't fully understand it because there's always has to be at least a little bit of a negative. But you know, these lawyers, we've gotten really crafty and we've gotten really sneaky. Mm-hmm. I always like to joke about the saying, you don't necessarily need to control your money. You just need to have like a relationship or an understanding of the person who controls your money. Mm-hmm. I always call this sort of, and I don't want to be too direct, it's a concept of like the yes man trustee. So someone that's independent enough to honor the wishes of the document, but still be somewhat deferential to the person the trust was created for. So Sam, if you created a trust for yourself and you named me as your trustee, mm-hmm. I know that the purpose of the trust is to benefit you. And theoretically, I need to make sure that I use my discretion in a way that helps you. And if I don't, you need to have some kind of mechanism to fire me and find somebody else. Mm-hmm. So even though you've given up the ability to say, pick the stocks in the trust, you know that if you call me up and say, Matt, I'd really like you to buy these five stocks, as long as you're not completely out of line or going crazy, I should and I probably will say yes if we have a good relationship, a trustee-beneficiary relationship. That's kind of how it works best, in my opinion, mm-hmm. when you have a good relationship. There's even further nuances to that, because I told you that the IRS says that you can't have control over your money except to give yourself health, education, and maintenance. Mm-hmm. They've continually carved that out. You can actually break up the powers of trustee. So while you might not be able to make discretionary distributions, maybe it is okay for you to make investment decisions. So when Sam Marks calls up Sam Marks and says, hey, can I have $50,000 in cash? Sam Marks doesn't have the authority to say, here you go. But maybe we can give Sam the ability to manage his Fidelity investment account or whatever investment place he's using. So you pick all the stocks, and when you want money, you call up Matt, who's the distribution trustee, and I say, here's your 50 grand, Sam. You've done a great job investing. Keep up the good work. There is a fine line there, and it's a little outside the scope to go in detail on what that line is. Mm-hmm. Plus, it's always changing. But you should really talk that through with your trust advisor, because if you have a high understanding of the trust process and you've spent the time learning and building a relationship, you can carve that out. Like investment provisions is one. So you could put like $10 million in a trust, and you could use that for example, angel investing, only invest in businesses that you think make sense. Mm-hmm. The only thing you can't do is pay yourself.
Right. So what's the fun of that then? Like you can grow the assets, but you can't deploy it except for investing. Like you could do some fun stuff. You could go buy like a vineyard and then you'd have access to that. Or
I don't want to get the... don't want to trigger the IRS too much because they're usually the ones that get worried in this, mm-hmm. but it gets even more nuanced. Now, if you're buying a business inside your trust and your trust is now hiring a CEO and they hire you as a CEO, mm-hmm. it's not really a distribution. You're being paid a salary.
Right.
That's where you get to the real fun you can have. So the more you understand your trust, the more you can do, and the better relationship you build with your estate planning lawyer, mm-hmm. that he's your trusted guide, the more comfortable you're going to be giving him control. At the end of the day, you want to give your estate planning lawyer as much control as you can, as long as you have an out clause to get back if you need to, because it frees you to do things like buy a vineyard, I don't know, hire Sam to be the head, I don't know, vignette or whatever it's mm-hmm. called, sommelier or whatever you want to say. Mm-hmm. And then, hey, you know what? Sam needs to do some research and really taste out all these wines. Let's expense him going on that. As long as it's for a valid business purpose. I mean, you are flying a little bit too close to the sun, mm-hmm. potentially. Mm-hmm. So you got to be a little careful, because what do they always say? You know, pigs get fed, hogs get slaughtered. Right. If you're doing these kind of concepts, it means you trust your lawyer a lot. You've built a great relationship with him. Like, just keep leaning on him heavier, yeah. honestly. It just gives you so much more protection at that point.
So suffice to say that it's not as easy as setting this up and then just going and writing a check for whatever you want to do, lifestyle, consumption, anything like that. But there is ways that you can carve it out to still have a little bit of flexibility while still being organized correctly.
Absolutely. What you don't want to do is say, here's this this high fee for this really complicated asset protection trust, I'm never going to see you again, and walk away mm-hmm. from your lawyer, and kind of, and a lot of attorneys do that model. It just doesn't work. And that really leads to a lot of buyer's remorse mm-hmm. because you do need those back doors. You do need that flexibility. So treat it like a marriage, if you will, almost like you're getting a relationship with someone that's always going to have your back. Make sure you feel good about them and make sure you're comfortable talking to them. I wouldn't recommend you saying meeting a guy three times, setting up an asset protection trust and just kind of walking away because mm-hmm. you're just not going to understand how it works. I mean, I like to joke, I've been doing some form of estate planning for, God, I started working in life insurance of all things when I was 18. So 16 years, and I still learn new things about trusts every day, just how they work and what levers you can pull. Mm-hmm. It should be an ongoing thing to really protect you.
And what happens to an asset protection trust when you pass on? Can that be liquidated for your heirs, or does it stay in that type of structure?
It can be liquidated for your heirs. Usually you'd want it to stay in for your structure. What's really interesting about the current United States estate tax process is when you put assets into trust, you're usually using various exemptions. The federal exemption right now is, I think, $11.2 million. That means you can put $11.2 million tax-free into a trust. What's interesting, and that's each husband and wife. Mm-hmm. What's interesting, there is a second tax that not many people know about called the generation skipping tax. And it's another like 45% tax roughly.
Wow.
That's what the estate tax is too, by the way. If you ever get above that $11.2 million number, it's pretty high.
But that 11 number is higher now, right? It used to be 5 and then Trump increased it.
Yeah, it used to be 5 and before that it was 2 and then it was 1. I mean, it's changed.
45%? Oh my gosh, that's crazy.
I think
the
estate tax is 40. I think the generation skipping tax is 45. I don't even know offhand, just because the way usually you're doing the planning, you're exempting both and we're trying to avoid paying those.
Jeez.
Goes up every year. But the moral of the story is, if you exempt $11.2 million in an asset protection trust, if you then give it to your kids one day or your grandkids, you've still exempted the same $11.2 million for generation skipping. So it's double tax-free. So by paying it out to your kids outright, you'd be subjecting to that tax. So if you're trying to create truly like dynasty level wealth, the goal is to pay that tax as few times as possible. Mm-hmm. So you're going to want to stretch it out at least a generation or two before you kind of say, here's your $11.2 million mm-hmm. cash. And really, I mean, I don't know many people that need access to that much cash without advice and things along those lines. Mm-hmm. Like, you're usually going to want to talk to someone, run it by the lawyer anyway. Use it as a shield, man. The trust is there to protect you. Not to stop you from doing what you want, but to protect you and maybe slow you down if you're doing something a little too irregular.
Right.
But that's a big trick. And there's actually these things called dynasty trusts, to be specific. They're trusts designed to last like 400 years. You have to be really careful, and you have to pick the right state to do it in. They started out, I think, I want to say out of Alaska originally, because Alaska's statute's 400 years that you can have this trust for. So you could potentially not pay that tax for 400 years. You can get a lot of generations in there. Which is pretty cool.
Okay, I was going to say, how does all this family wealth continue to transfer and grow over time if every time someone dies they're paying 45% on what they transfer? Assuming the transfer tax used to be a lot lower on a lower cap, which was like 1 or 2 million, you know. So if they transfer 100 million at death, you get taxed 45%. There's basically 50 left. That seems, you know, it's still a lot of money, and over the course of a lifetime, if it's managed right, it can grow a lot. But it seems like it's much more difficult to continue to transfer wealth to your heirs and have them be able to grow it. In this, you always hear about these families that have just been wealthy for hundreds and hundreds of years.
Yeah, I mean, the truth is, I mean, if you go back to like the Rockefellers and the Mellons and all those guys, they all had trust set up, lots of them, and the rules are a little different now than then. Mm-hmm. Whether they were done correctly or not, most people don't even know, because no one even sees the light of day on this stuff. Yeah. It's all kept really ambiguous and secret. And you can't plan, if you have even close to $10 million, you can't possibly plan to turn that into intergenerational wealth without a lawyer. You absolutely need one. They'll mm-hmm. pay for themselves and then something. But there's so many techniques that you can use and apply. Not only that, there's other techniques to refund the balance sheet, if you will. Mm-hmm. I mean, we do things called insurance trusts, where you actually buy a certain amount of insurance just to pay the tax mm-hmm. so that your wealth continues to grow and that your kids and your grandkids have the same opportunities that you did. It's kind of funny, but that's sort of what I've always kind of thought was really important in estate planning. Mm-hmm. It's sort of a family bank concept, and that's whatever you leave to your kids, you got to make sure that they understand they owe it to their kids and then their kids and then their kids. And once you've instilled that in your family, that's how you create real wealth. Like, you use that loan, if you will, that going to school or whatever else, to just sort of build your own empire mm-hmm. and then put it back in, pay it forward. Because I don't know about you, but nothing's more depressing than me than having a lot of family wealth and then being looking back on the world and saying, oh, wait, grandma or grandpa spent it all and now we have to start over again. I don't know. Maybe it's just the profession I'm in. I just see it as a lost opportunity because right. in our businesses, capitals, I mean, money grows money, mm-hmm. as you know. The more money you have, the bigger you could go. And if you're actually, if you're setting your family wealth back, mm-hmm. you kind of let them down.
I know there's cost to setting these things up. You know, is there a certain wealth level that it makes sense? Absolutely. Like, you have 5 million, you're planning to have kids. You have 5 million, you have kids. This is something you need to set up. But if you're at 500,000 in net wealth, maybe it doesn't make sense. Do you see kind of a certain line in the sand where you're like, you need to be taking action on this?
Yeah, I mean, there's a tool for every wealth level first. So absolutely, like, I don't care if you have $20,000 in the bank and you still need a basic will and basic documents. When you start getting into the basics of trusts, I usually don't base it on actual wealth. I base it on like wealth per beneficiary. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to leave, I'd say about $200,000 per kid, that's when you start having a conversation about trust. You may decide not to buy, to go for the trust avenue, because I always say the basic living trust technique's about 5 times as expensive as a will, but you should at least start to understand it. Mm-hmm. And then as you start getting close to those estate tax exemptions, which is $11 million, you pretty much have to do it. You don't have a choice. Mm-hmm. You really need to do competent tax planning at that point. Because it saves you too much money when you're looking at a 40% federal tax plus 12% local. Mm-hmm. It's just too much. Plus, when there's just so many little avenues and in there and ways to kind of make that money really last. Yeah. But there is a right level for every person.
And also, I've just went through this experience recently. So I have, it was an unpleasant experience. My grandma passed away last year.
Sorry to hear that.
Yeah, it's, you know, I think the worst part about it was just everything that happened afterwards. You know, it's sad to say, but it was just a lot of, I think, like, in the future when I pass away and I have kids, I want them just to be able to like continue without thought, you know, just remember me in hopefully good memories, but not have any extra stress or planning or anything else. Just let them continue living their lives kind of without any hazards. And when my grandma passed away, there was, I think she organized things fairly well, but there was still quite a bit that was required, that things that went into probate and safety to security deposit boxes that didn't have keys and lots of documents that weren't really clear. It's not like it's the end of the world, but it created a little bit of stress and obstacles in the 6 months or year that passed. And it just made me think that there has to be steps to organize this in a better way. And that's something that I think a lot of people should be thinking about, is after they're gone, you know, whatever you haven't cleaned up, someone else is going to have to clean up. And that's personally not how I would want to, you know, I would want things left. So is there, like, you know, what are the recommended steps on just making sure things are clean and organized and people can just pick up and continue on?
Well, when people pass away, there's always a certain amount of uncertainty in working through the process, and it is probably impossible to completely avoid it. I mean, that's one challenge. What I've started to realize and I've learned, and again, I learn from my clients every day, but I remember I said in the beginning of the meeting or conversation that I like to be the smartest guy in the room. Mm-hmm. I've just kind of learned that if I can become the smartest guy about you, Sam, and get to know you and have you trust me and make sure I've learned everything about you. And hopefully we've built such a relationship that you've wanted to introduce me to your kids, your grandkids, and we've kind of kept that dialogue going. I actually started a program I call my Thriving Family Program, where I meet with people's kids for free just to kind of explain the plan to them. Mm-hmm. So what happens is when grandma dies, you sit down in my office and talk to me, and we already know each other. We already know the plan, and I know where all the pieces are. And I say, you know what, Sam? It's really a sad moment. I want you to focus on your family. Mm-hmm. I have everything under control. We'll meet once every couple months and sign some documents, but I'll do it all for you. and I'm just going to show you the documents and ask for your approval. But because I'm quote unquote the smartest guy in the room and I've already gathered all the documents, my team just goes through and does it all so that you're not schlepping all over the place and stressing about it.
Yeah.
We do all the hard work, but there is account re-registration, tax ID numbers, all that good stuff. I mean, we have a great accountant we use as well. I think you actually know him. I use Mario Lucibello for a lot of our probate matters and trust matters.
Shout out to Mario.
Pretty phenomenal trust accountant. Yeah. But and little things like that, and we do that all behind the scenes. And you just kind of come in the office and you make some small talk, or we call you in Asia and ship you out some documents to sign and be like, we've done all the legwork.
Yeah.
This is what your grandmother wanted. Double check it. Make sure that obviously we're not ripping you off or anything. Not that we would, but I get that's part of the process of learning it. And if we already have a relationship, it's smooth and easy. And that's the human element's more important than anything else. You can do the best documents in the world, but if you don't have a person there that you like and trust and know, and that knows how to do it, like, you're screwed. So that's what I've been focusing on lately. And you have to have great documents, but they're pretty much free. I tell people you can have the documents for free, but I'm not cheap.
Have you seen these matters like rip families apart? I mean, even like good families, I imagine this can be really taxing on them, and it's already a hard time, and then trying to figure out this and deal with, no offense, attorneys and the state and everyone else, that can be a really stressful process.
I don't take an offense to it. Our profession's part of the problem. The truth is, yes, it usually tears families apart if done incorrectly. And it's not about the documents. It's about the person holding the hand after they pass away. The typical attorney response is, and they always say the same thing whenever they see something that the heirs are upset about, and it's, that's what my client wanted. Whether it's true or not, they always say that's what my client wanted. In my experience going through probate, a lot of times, not necessarily my documents so much, but other people's documents, a lot of times the kids come in and they say, that's not what grandma would have wanted.
Yeah.
And a lot of times they're right, because if you actually were to actually talk to their grandma, she didn't understand her estate plan. She didn't take the time to dissect it and dig as deep as you and I are talking about right now. Yeah. And as an attorney, when I read a document, I can see the part that's like from the attorney, meaning, hey, this is the attorney's style versus this is something the grandmother specifically asked for, like the boilerplate versus the not boilerplate, if you will. So when an heir comes in and he's like, I'm really upset about this clause, why would she say this to me? And it starts tearing the family apart. I don't usually say that's what my client wanted. I say, listen, this is not one of the provisions you should be upset about. This is like attorney language. Mm-hmm. You need to focus on these clauses that are clearly straight from your grandmother's mouth. Those are things she emotionally cared about. The thing you're upset about right now, she probably didn't even know she did.
Right.
I mean, I had a situation recently with my own grandmother. She had a trustee who was, after her husband passed away, was co-trustees with her. And she really didn't like having to work with the person every day, because she used to joke that this guy was pretty much her daddy and would tell her what to do all the time, and she didn't want to deal with that. And she was very upset that her husband would leave her with someone else forcing her, not trusting her. And I had to be like, listen, like, I know your attorney, you know, I didn't do this estate plan, told you that this is what your husband wanted, but most likely that was a stylistic choice. Like, he put this person on there because that's what that attorney does all the time. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And that you got to be really careful with that. And I think from our perspective as stewards of making the handoff, so example, after your grandmother dies, handing the wealth off to your family and making sure that handshake is successful and that everybody's happy, I kind of think it's the attorney's job to kind of explain the intent and sort of explain what was personal, what was not personal, and kind of make sure it's a smooth transition. And we suck at it as a profession, and I apologize for that.
Oh, interesting stuff. It's very complicated, I have to be honest. I've taken a look at trust and all this stuff, and this was my first experience going through any type of probate and things. It's complicated, and I think that just goes to demonstrate why it's so important in life to have a good accountant and a good lawyer that you trust, and hopefully make lifelong relationships with both of them as you continue through.
We just scratched the surface on trust. Like I said, a trust is a blank sheet of paper. You can dream up anything you want, but each thing has a different repercussion. But the relationship matters.
And this stuff is pretty important. Like, if you want to plan around the things that we just discussed, I think it's also somewhat important to get it done at an earlier age than you would expect, because I know, you know, I've seen a lot of older people, unfortunately, like last 5 or 10 years, they're just not all there. And
I don't know how competently they could put together all these things that are already inherently very complicated things, you know, when you're not 100%.
Yeah, I joke a lot, but the truth is it's impossible to make a world-class trust on your first try. Mm-hmm. Not because of the attorney necessarily, but because you as the client, Sam, need to have a deep understanding on all the levers that you can pull. Mm-hmm. Like, I never even bring up that you can have investment management control, because mm-hmm. that's like a second conversation. Like, you've had your trust for a couple of years, you understand it, you're great. Now you're going back and you want to get even more nuanced. Mm-hmm. Like, the earlier you start, the deeper your understanding of how a trust works, the better you can craft your documents to leave what's truly a profound legacy, like the 400-year kind of legacy.
Right.
So those are either you have to learn that on your own, or you just have to be like with the attorney's guidance, or you have to be very trusting of your attorney and kind of give them right. the keys and say, I trust you. What do what you would do for your family.
Great stuff. Matt, I just want to summarize with a couple of key points as they're coming sure. through my head. I haven't written down notes. I'm looking forward to listening to this episode again. But things that came to mind are, A, make sure that you at very minimum, everyone out there should have a will. Everyone out there should have a durable power of attorney along with a healthcare power of attorney. Is that correct?
Correct.
And then when you are planning on giving at least $200,000 to any of your heirs, you should really start thinking about having a trust in place. And as you get closer to that kind of $11 million mark, at least in the USA, then you have to, basically. Otherwise, you're just surrendering money to the government. If that's what you want to do, then you can do that.
Yeah. I would also add in, if you have assets in multiple states at a lower level, mm-hmm. or if you're an international citizen, you absolutely need to have, or international resident of assets overseas, you definitely need to have that trust conversation earlier.
Yeah.
But a whole different conversation for a different day.
Right. Yeah. And it's not all just about you in this lifetime. It's about those that might follow you. So give that some thought. I think it's important. But glad we have professionals like you handling this stuff. I wish it wasn't so complicated, but I know that's how the U.S. government likes to do things, and I know a lot of other governments as well. So keep navigating. Matt, thanks. It's been a lot of fun having you on the show, and appreciate your time.
I appreciate it, Sam. Have a good one.
All right, that was a ton of good information. I'm excited to unpack it all. But real quick, I want to thank everyone who's left 5-star reviews of the podcast on iTunes. You guys are the reason why we're able to get these great guests and be able to keep growing this podcast and get this information out there for everyone. So this week, I want to thank Is Rami, who says, my favorite podcast, 5 stars. About a year ago, I was looking for a good podcast to listen to on a long road trip from Arizona to Texas. I did a search and stumbled upon Invest Like a Boss, and I gave it a shot. 14 hours later, I had listened to 10 episodes. These guys are great. They seem real and someone I can have a beer with.
Yes.
So thank you very much. We would love to have a beer with you, maybe at the next Invest Like a Boss Summit. That's going to be in Vegas. I think we're going to do it end of September. Mm-hmm. If you guys want to sign up, go to the Boss Lounge on our Facebook page. Look for Boss Lounge on Facebook or go to investlikeaboss.com, click on bonus and get some info there.
Yeah. And if any, and on the topic of beer, if anyone has a favorite craft beer company in the US, give us a shout and let us know, because what we're going to do is we're going to get a craft beer sponsor so you guys can all drink some frosty brews while we talk about making money.
Yeah, that'd be pretty cool. I don't know how the hotel's going to let us bring it in, but I'm sure I'll let that be your job. You're going to be Sam's job is going to be to
– it's the same as Thailand. You just bring it in the back door.
Oh, yeah. I think it's very different than Thailand. And that's what I love about Thailand is you can basically just do anything with no rules. I mean, and yeah. Vegas is going to be a pain, but it's also so much fun. So, yeah, we hope to see everyone there.
Yep.
All right.
Definitely.
So let's talk about this week's episode. I'm excited about this. I'm really glad you brought Matt on, because this is a really important topic that most of us don't think about.
It is absolutely important. And unfortunately, at some point in everyone's life, you're going to go through the passing of someone. And it seems like the aftermath is very convoluted in the US compared to other countries. But I'm sure every country has its own issues and has very similar issues with infighting of families and probate and trying to figure out who owns what when things aren't documented properly. So we talk about making money on this podcast and managing your investments on this podcast, but we've never talked about anything like this in detail. So happy to have Matt on and explain some of the
easy things that everyone can do to kind of prepare for these events.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's perfect that Sam and I are in completely different places. I think that in Sam's situation, you should definitely just go all in, you know, use Matt or use someone that you trust, you know, kind of with similar expertise and set up a trust. I think that's it's kind of a no-brainer.
Yeah, I think it makes sense. I've actually talked to Matt a few times about this, and it's very similar to think to so many people in like positions, even if they're young like me, but especially, and if they're older as well, it's just like you put it off, you delay it until maybe something happens that really triggers you, like, oh shit, I need to get this together. But it's surprising how many people out there have inherited a ton of money or have made a lot of money and they're just doing nothing because it's more paperwork, it's more, you know, bandwidth in your head, it's more bureaucracy and things to deal with. But you always have to plan for the future and you always have to plan for loved ones, and you want to make your legacy as bright and prominent as you can. In most cases, I think most people would agree with that. And keeping things easy and streamlined for your loved ones after you pass and leaving them with as much money as possible is very important.
Yeah, because you don't want that money going 40% to the tax man for no reason when you can. I mean, if you really want to just give it away, you know, give it to charity when you die, but don't just have it, you know, slip through the system.
Yeah, I agree. So, Johnny, you said you don't have a will yet. Are you planning on taking any action off after this episode?
Yeah, actually, during this episode, while listening to it, I went online. I went on, I think, doyourwill.com. I think that was the website. And I filled it out. Doyourownwill.com. It's a free online service. Okay. So disclaimer, doing a free online will probably isn't as good as going through a lawyer.
paying $20 to like LegalZoom maybe, but yeah. I don't know.
But
I think honestly a will can be as simple as like someone writing on a piece of paper what their wishes are, signing it, and like leaving maybe one extra validation, like a thumbprint or a photo of your license or something. But I don't think you have to get super complicated. Something is better than nothing. If you pass and someone finds it, it's probably going to be better than nothing.
Yeah, I can see that being better than nothing. And that's honestly why I'm doing my own will online, is because I know I'm not going to go through an attorney right now. I don't really have a reason to. Mm-hmm. So I think in my situation, and what I would probably recommend to anyone in my situation too, you know, you don't have any dependents, you're not married, and it's not, you know, more than, you know, $1 million, and you don't really care who gets the money, go to doyourownwill.com and just do something, just have it. But what was really cool about it is it kind of just walked me through all the questions I probably would have forgot myself. I mean, I would have just wrote, mm-hmm. you know, 25% goes to this person, 50% goes to this person. But what these forms do, and I'm sure this is really similar to what an attorney would draft up, is then they'll put in a clause that says, okay, well, what if these people, you know, the people that you put down, let's say, you know, you put down four people, what if they're dead? Then what happens to the money?
Ooh.
All right. Or
Johnny's whole familia is taken out.
Yeah. Or like, what if, I mean, because you think about it, I mean, like, you know, for me, I have my parents as 50%, and chances are, I mean, I'm going to outlive them. So, you know, there's a mm-hmm. chance that I might not update the will, and
that's true.
They're still on there. So where does that money go? There's a clause that says, like, what if that person just refuses the money? If they don't want it for some reason, or they just can't get in touch with them. Then what do you do? So I think it was really, really nice kind of just walking through all this and kind of figuring out, what are the questions that people would ask? And then to kind of verify the whole thing, you just need to have two witnesses watch you sign. So, and they have to put down their information. And then if you really want to take it a step further, you can do all that in front of a notary public. So that way you're not really going through the whole legal process per se, but then you're paying, you know, and I think there's like notary apps now where you can have a notary come to you. You can have two buddies over. You can be like, hey, watch me sign this. Have the notary kind of do the stamp, and that's it. So for like $25 or whatever it is, you can have a will.
Nice. Well, so that's an update on my comments that at least try to get it notarized or have witnesses sign to make it a little bit more official. But Johnny, so tell us, who made it into your will?
Yes.
Where are the assets going?
So, okay. Disclaimer, this could change in the future, you know, like when I have kids or, you know, if I get married. But for right now, you know, if I get hit by a bus tomorrow, which is very likely because I'm actually in Sri Lanka right now.
Or if you fall out of a tuk-tuk in Colombo.
Yeah. ran over by a herd of pachyderm. There's like, so very likely. So this is officially my will until I create another will. Just putting this out there. You guys are all my witness. We have, you know, 3,000 witnesses. We have Sam as my witness as well. 25% is going to go to my cousin Jacob just because he's, you know, one of my favorite people in the world. And I know it'll help him out, you know, pay off some debts and kind of just, you know, ball out, enjoy himself. Right. I have 25% going to my mom, 25% going to my dad, you know, just so they can kind of have a nice retirement when they, you know, as they're getting older. And then I have 25% going to my ex-girlfrend, Larissa, because, you know, I mean, you know, we're together for 3 years, you know, I know she can really use the money. She really loved me. So until, you know, I get married.
She shared a bed with you for 3 years. Yeah. I mean, that's got to be worth something.
With my stuff. No, but like, you know, I just figure like, I think of it as, you know, 25%, you know, can go to someone like who, you know, who I care about. But that obviously that's going to have to change over to like whoever I'm with. Like if I get married with someone, obviously they're going to get that instead. Right. So that's like, I didn't even tell Larissa this because I don't want her getting her hopes up. And then, you know, 5 years later, I'm dating someone else. And then, or I get married and then I'm like, all right, well, I got to cross you off, obviously.
Yeah.
But, you know, if I get, you know, if I die tomorrow, you know, it's hers.
Good, man. Yeah. Well, that's great that you put that together. I'm glad this episode triggered this, you know, this legal goodwill of yours.
Yeah. You know, actually, it's actually been on there for a while because I remember in, I think it's on, what is the RoboAdvisor again? Wealthfront. It asked like who should get the money. And I actually remember putting her down, you know, years ago when I first opened it, and I just never bothered changing it. And that's actually kind of what sparked thinking like, okay, if I'm gonna make this will, I'll kind of leave it like that. Now, the reason why my sister and my niece and nephew are not on there is because, you know, we fight a lot and, you know, she's annoying enough. But no, but
I feel the same.
Yeah. But actually the clause is if, you know, if either my mom or my dad, you know, pass away, then she gets the money. And chances are, you know, they're gonna be gone by the time I die, or, you know, she's gonna have to kinda hold on until they do pass, and they'll get the money from her from them anyway. Nice. So it kinda trickles down.
Okay. I like it, man. Yeah. I like it.
What about you?
Yeah. So I actually, just as you were talking about this, I pulled mine up because I wrote mine about 2 years ago, and I literally just wrote it on, in a Microsoft Word doc.
Okay.
And then I printed and signed it, and I put a copy in, I think, my parents' safety deposit box, and then also like one in my safety deposit box.
Okay.
So generally easy to find, two copies. But a good point that you mentioned about putting listing beneficiaries on your investment accounts. So everyone out there that has an investment account, whether it's Wealthfront, Vanguard, whatever, almost all of them will have, or a bank, even a bank, will have the ability to put a beneficiary on there. Go ahead and do that because that makes everything even easier than just having a will. You can also mention it in the will that, you know, they're listed as a beneficiary. But when it comes to changing that account over or liquidating an account, having the beneficiary on it is going to make it a lot easier. So that's a good first step. So I just pulled mine up. Never thought I would disclose this, but what the hell? So I made it so that my parents get 100% of everything.
Wow.
And then I left. Well, but then I left them instructions on what to do with it.
Okay.
Because I just figured instead of having 15 people navigate like how to get to an account, it's easier just to give it to my parents and then have my parents contact those people, which I, of course, trust them to do. So so they get 100%. And then of that, Child's Dream, which Johnny, you and I did the walk across Ireland to benefit.
Uh-huh.
So they would basically get 5%. And that would be specifically to build, looks like I made 80 playgrounds over the course of the next 5 years in Southeast Asia.
Nice.
My sister gets a little bit. I'm not going to say how much because, you know, she can be pretty aggressive. And if she thinks it's a lot of money, you never know. So my girlfriend, Uwe, who can actually hear me right now, also can be dangerous at times, is entitled to my Thai condos.
Oh,
and a little bit else, but I'm not going to say what that is. Okay. But that's also like I was thinking about these things as I was planning it now that I recall. And I was thinking about these also in terms of easeability for everybody. Like if my parents have to go and try to figure out how to take custody of my Thai condos, I just think it's more headache for them, you know?
Yeah, that makes sense.
And then Fabian Lorson, who actually has been a good friend of mine, is a young entrepreneur who has been very supportive of my businesses, and I've always been supportive of him. I left some cash so that he can start his own business and also start investing. Fern, who's my old assistant, also been very supportive and is a new mother. I left one small condo in Thailand. So actually I left my girlfriend Uwe 4 and Fern 1.
Okay.
And then for all of my startup investments, I left that to my friend Anthony Mergio, who's actually in jail right now. But he's been one of my best friends my entire life, super supportive. And honestly, I think he's the only one that would know how to navigate taking custody of my ownership of my startup investments, which are like in, you know, from Barcelona to Australia to Singapore to the US. So I just left him like pretty simple instructions on like contact information. And if he can navigate it, that whole portfolio is his, baby. Wow,
nice. Okay.
And then I left instructions to send all my good friends on a trip together. So like, I left a list of names. Johnny, you're included in that.
Oh, nice.
For like, you know, a big blowout party event. And just like ideas of what they could do with it as like a big friends trip. So yeah, that was kind of cool. And then I left some like fun instructions on what to do with my stuff. I think it was kind of cool to do in this will too. Like if you're writing one, it's kind of, it feels weird to write it, no doubt. And if you're writing it, you're planning for a negative future event that could happen. None of us want it to happen, of course. But if you're writing it, think about who's going to be reading it. You know, it's probably going to be a sad position. And I think it's nice to like include a little joke or something that's a little cheerful in there. So maybe you might have like some funny remark on how you want to be buried, or just like a joke or inside joke or something fun that you can include in it, because I think majority of wills are just very serious to the point.
They are.
And it's probably, this might be the last literature that anyone ever reads of yours. So it might be fun just to think of something fun to put in there.
Well, what's actually kind of funny about that is I was reading. So after, you know, after filling mine out, it basically auto generates a will based on everything I said. And most of it is pretty dry, right? It's, you know, I, Johnny Jen, a resident of state of Texas, make, publish, and declare this my last will and testament. And, you know, first, I direct expenses. And it's like pretty dry. And the only part that actually really shows my personality and kind of like what I care about is, I think it was under the, you know, like what to do with my body. I checked, you know, cremation, and then they said like, any other instructions. And I actually wrote, please lightly bury my ashes at my grandparents' plot 2 to 3 inches below ground and just have close family there. Cremate my body in whatever city I die in. Do not embalm it or use any fancy caskets or urns. Just do it as basic as possible. Put my ashes in a clear Ziploc bag and mail it to San Francisco.
Right. Here lies Johnny on the plastic bag.
Yeah. Because I'm like, man, you know, I like the funeral industry actually really pisses me off because they really take advantage of people at like a really bad time, and they make they try to sell these like stupid packages, these crazy expensive caskets or urns. And like the thing is, you know, you don't want to feel cheap, right? And you're like, well, you know, maybe Johnny would have wanted that. I'm like, no, I don't want that. No, I like just burn my body, put it in a Ziploc bag, mail it, you know, post, you know, like postal service. You know, there's no rush. And that's just funny. Just like
the frugal route, stay true to the very end.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, because they even do things like, okay, for example, like even if you want to be cremated, sometimes they'll try to sell you like a fancy wooden box to be burned in. And I'm like, no, just use some plywood, just whatever the cheapest thing is. And then what they try to do is they try to embalm you before they burn you. Which makes no sense because they're going to burn you anyways. But it's just like another step where they can make money.
Yeah, and I'm sure most people, when there's not instructions and family members have to deal with it, they're just like, they want to spend as least time thinking about it as possible. So they're probably just like, just, you know, go with whatever guidance that they're given. And therein lies a huge opportunity for funeral services to take advantage of people in a time of mourning. So yeah, I think it's good that you've thought about that. That's more detail than I wanted to think about it in. I should, but maybe that'll be phase two for me and updating this at some point.
I don't know, man. Mine's going to be cheap as, and I want to leave everyone knowing this is why I left everyone so much money, is because I didn't spend it when I was alive. You know, like my memorial service, you know, I'm like, I should probably write, like, let's have this at like a Sizzler buffet or something.
Yes. Dude, why don't you leave, like, you should leave a new... What are those, like, that lady that sells the lemonade by you in Chiang Mai?
Oh, I don't. What do you mean?
You know the lemonade that you always, they were like, we're drinking it during last few episodes.
Oh yeah, it wasn't lemonade. It was like some kombucha or something. But what about it?
Okay. Yeah, you should buy her like a new cart with like flashy wheels and stuff.
Okay, all right, that'd be nice.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. We should get back to Chiang Mai. Chiang Mai's been good to us.
Yeah, I do like Thailand, so I don't know. Yeah.
We'll brainstorm on this. Yeah. Okay. We'll brainstorm on this.
Well, I mean, all the money in my Thai bank account, I guess, can go somewhere.
Yeah. I'm not gonna be able to use Thai authorities. Just more. Oh, God. Maybe what we should do is we should pay out every police officer in Chiang Mai 500 baht for the last time.
No. Never again.
Won't be getting any more scooter fines. So here you guys go. One last payout.
Yeah, but you know what? It is kind of fun thinking about what we could leave behind, because I think most people just leave behind like debt and misery, and it's, I don't know. I think on one hand, I've never really been enamored, you know, thinking like I want to leave behind generational wealth. I never really thought first it would be possible for me, but I think even thinking about it now, I don't really think, like, if my future kids would be that much better off in inheriting millions of dollars, you know, even if we structure it correctly, you know, because, like, I mean, I know it's a...
No, I don't... I agree. I don't think anyone is going to be better off inheriting $10 million. I think the average person out there, it's not going to make happier. It's going to be cool for 6 months, and then it's going to lead to, you know, some negative feelings and emotion. I've talked to a lot of smart people, and almost all the wealthy people are going to leave a lot behind, right? But it seems like really smart people are like, nah, I think, you know, the most that makes sense to leave behind is a house. Leave a house. It could be a nice house, but leave a house. And that's like, that's a great thing to inherit. It gives you a base and stability. If you're not doing well, it's a bonus if you are doing well. But it's really a hard decision to say, no, I'm going to give it all away and not leave loved ones with something that has a potential to positively impact their life. But that's a decision everyone's got to think about, and a situation they got to analyze their own people that they're leaving things behind and see how well they think that they can handle it.
Yeah, definitely. I think that if I had millions of dollars, what I would do is I would write us, you know, I would create some kind of like...
have millions of dollars.
When I have millions of dollars. Thank you. And when I have kids, I guess, too. Two big ifs. But I would definitely go through the process of creating like a very specific trust, where I would have something like, until they're 18, I want, you know, like their school and their living expenses covered, but only up to, you know, 50 grand a year or something like that. Something reasonable, you know. And then after that, when they turn 18, what I'll probably do is I'll match any money they earn. So if they make 20 grand a year, I'll give them another 20 grand. You know, if they make 100 like grand a year, they get another 100 grand. And that like way, they're always getting something, but they have to work for it as well.
Yeah, I like that a lot, John. It's like sponsored 401k.
Yeah. And you know, and if they want to make $1 million a year, then, you know, they can get another million.
Yeah, I like that a lot. Smart man. Thinking ahead. Yeah, I want to be Johnny's kid.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think you want to be my kid. I'm gonna be kind of a hard ass. But so the other part actually that was brought up was what to do about like health, like, you know, health, you know, besides just the burial. Like, what do you want to do if you are a vegetable? are they going to pull the plug or not? That's actually something I filled out a few years ago. My cousin is a doctor, and I basically just filled out like a healthcare directive and I just emailed it to her. Mm-hmm. So shout out to Catherine. And I basically said, like, I filled it out saying, like, if I'm going to be a vegetable, just pull the plug. Don't spend any more money. Don't keep me alive.
Okay. I haven't thought about that one. I think I'm going to put it off.
Yeah?
Yeah.
No, you can't pull it. No, you got to decide. Dude, okay. If it's irreversible, there's no chance.
If you make enough money, isn't like anything scientifically possible in the next 10 years, like with all the stem cell stuff and everything, let's just focus on making more money.
Okay.
And then in 10 years, maybe you should write that clause like after 10 years if nothing's available, because there's got to be something.
10
like
years.
All this new neuroscience, nanotechnologies.
Yeah.
Everything.
I think the main reason that most people should pull the plug is if it becomes a financial burden on others.
Yeah.
But then, like, you know, if you have the money, I guess that's something that, you know, the last thing you buy. But like, all right, you know, I'm gonna give myself one chance, right?
Yeah, so maybe they can find a way, like, even if you're in that unfortunate position, that they can kind of like stimulate your brain just so there's like happy endorphins running around. I don't know.
I wouldn't even want that.
I have just a lot of just pull faith the plug. And confidence.
Let me die.
I have a lot of faith and confidence in the future of medicine and science. So I think in 10 years, hopefully a lot of these tragedies can be averted and situations improved.
Well,
but I see what you're saying.
Either way, I'm glad we're able to talk about this and even think about it. I think these are conversations that really everybody should be, you know, having, at least with themselves, right? You know, or you know, close friends. It is pretty out there for us to be this open about it on air, you know, with thousands of people. But I think it's an important topic. So I'm really glad we brought it up this week.
Me too. So next week, let's get back to making some damn money, son.
All right. We'll see. Yeah. I don't know. I'm going to be here in Sri Lanka, not spending very much. It's like the cheapest country I've ever been into my life.
Yeah, and it's not my favorite place in the world, to be honest.
You've been to Sri Lanka?
Yeah, son. 100 well, countries now. How is Sri Lanka not going to be one of those?
All right.
Yeah. But dude, the mosquitoes, and I'll tell you, Tuk Tuk in Colombo was probably one of the most stressful situations I've ever been in my life. Like, they don't move, and then you have like these mega buses and tractors next to you just blowing massive amounts of exhaust straight into your Tuk Tuk, and like you feel like you're going to pass out. It's nuts. But
well, you know what?
I know there's beautiful parts of the island. Get up to the tea country.
I'm going to do that. I definitely will do that. Get some Ceylon tea.
Yes, exactly. But you know what? Like when you go to a brewery or a vineyard or even a whiskey distillery, you leave with like this appreciation of how it's made. And you're like, wow, I'm really going to enjoy that nice bottle of wine now. Uh-huh. When you go see tea, you're going to be like, I hate tea. This is some boring shit. Ah! I don't even want to drink it.
We'll see.
But it's pretty up there. You'll like it up there. Take a train ride.
Fun fact, I haven't been on a train or a tuk-tuk or a bus yet since I've been here.
Oh, well, you know that my Facebook photo that I've had for like the last 3 years.
Oh, that's from Sri Lanka.
That's in Sri Lanka. That's on the train up there.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So this has been a long episode. I appreciate everyone sticking with us through this one. Hope you got something out of it. Johnny, appreciate your transparency as always in talking about some of these sensitive subjects.
Yeah, you as well, Sam. It's been really fun. And we'll see all of you guys next week.
Thanks for listening to the Invest Like a Boss podcast. Join our mailing list at investlikeaboss.com to get exclusive access to our insider investment portfolios and our private members forum.
If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Tell your friends and leave us a review in the iTunes store. It helps more than you know. See you guys next week.